The following Bible study is presented by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
We had learned in the first study of Nahum, in the first chapter, that this book was written approximately 150 years after that of Jonah. Nahum prophesied about the coming destruction of Nineveh and the corresponding Assyrian Empire. Nineveh, as we know, had previously repented of her wickedness, that is, after Jonah's preaching, but 50 years later Assyria was allowed to rise up and conquer the northern tribes of Israel. The conquering army had regressed back to their old ways. They were brutal, and their bloodthirsty lust for power and treasure was quenched for a time anyway, while conquering the house of Israel. However, simply because God allowed Assyria to be used as a rod of his correction, God did not inspire or approve of Assyria's methods of war. As was stated in a previous study, and when we covered the book of Jonah, ancient stone tablets were found telling of horrific acts of violence and torture that was used by the armies of that wicked empire. Something else we had heard in the last study was how the prophecy of Nahum is dual, and it's believed that the Austrian and German people of today are descendants of Assyria. And for this reason, it was taught by Mr. Armstrong, and it continues to be understood by many, that the entire fulfillment of Nahum's prophecy is yet to come. In fact, there are several verses in this book that can only be understood in the light of end-time events. The book of Nahum contains words of warning and encouragement to God's people. And from verse to verse, we see that the targeted audience moves back and forth from speaking of the wicked empires of then and in the future. And it also speaks to the empires that would conquer the nation of Assyria. And it also mentions the children of Israel, who include the Church of God today. Chapter 2 in verse 1 begins to speak to the wicked people causing God's indignation. And when his words would be fulfilled, there would be no more warning. This was it. The time of retribution had come for Assyria, just as it will come to the future empire of the beast in Revelation. Chapter 2 and verse 1 states, "He who scatters has come up before your face," speaking of God. "Man the fort, watch the road, strengthen your flanks, fortify your power mightily." This verse explains how God is the one who sets up and takes down kings and their kingdoms, as stated in Daniel 2. In fact, God inspired the Chaldeans to rise up and conquer the empire of Assyria, and their defeat was complete in 605 BC. Though the Assyrians seem to be encouraged to bulk up and get ready for battle in this verse, these words are stated with sarcasm, because no matter what they might attempt to do in defense, God was behind their destruction, and so resistance would be entirely ineffective. In other words, do your best to fortify your defenses against God. It will be useless, because as it is said, if God be for us, who can be against us? Also, if God be against us, well, nothing can stop his retribution. He is God, and as God, he will do all his pleasure. And his pleasure is to eventually restore Israel to their land and to set up a world government that will be for the greater benefit of all humanity. And this is mentioned next in verse 2, where it says, "For the Eternal will restore the excellence of Jacob, like the excellence of Israel. For the emptiers have emptied them out and ruined their vine branches." Israel had been sacked and emptied of both its people and its wealth by Assyria. Their progeny, referred to as the vine branches, had been marred, that is, permanently scarred, as many were slaughtered and tribes became lost to history. And though we are aware of the location of some of these tribes today, such as Reuben and Dan, Ephraim and Manasseh, and of course Judah, most are now known as the lost tribes of Israel. They are unknown where they are throughout the world, and emptiers have emptied them out. The expression "to restore" means to turn back to a prior state of excellence. And Israel was a great nation under God, that is, when they were under the leadership of a good judge or a good king, such as King David and King Solomon for many, many years, their prosperity, in fact, came from God. And as the song goes, "How excellent in all the earth, the eternal, our God is his name." God's blessing has led to full storehouses and sufficient treasuries with coin to spare. And at times, Israel was even highly regarded among the other nations. The peace and prosperity God has shown to Israel in the past at times will return. But it would not be soon after the destruction of Assyria. It would take hundreds of years before a type of excellence as experienced under David and Solomon would be felt. In fact, the zeal of the era of Maccabees caused something like this to occur. And this is explained thoroughly in our book, Evidence for Eras, where it is shown that the era of the Maccabees was, in fact, the Philadelphian era of the Old Covenant. And the nation of Israel was highly respected for a time among the nations. However, that brief time in history is not what God spoke of here in chapter 2 and verse 2 of Nahum. The excellence of Jacob and Israel is yet to come, and it in fact will not take place until after the second Exodus. Still, this prophecy here does apply to times that have already passed. Nineveh had become wealthy through her rape and murder of nations. Assyria plundered the northern tribes of Israel. In fact, although Assyria was a great empire, in Nebuchadnezzar's vision of the image with a head of gold, Assyria is not even included among the great nations of the earth. And it's likely because God despised their brutal methods of war, along with, of course, their idolatrous religion. But there is also an application of these sentences to the future, which will be a time of Jacob's trouble. You see, war, violence, and captivity are coming for the nations who are descendants of Israel. And still, though it will be allowed and it will be carried out by a wicked empire inspired by Satan, God will avenge the brutality that will be unleashed on his people. In Nahum 2 and in verse 3, "The shields of his mighty men are made red. The valiant men are in scarlet. The chariots with flaming torches in the day of his preparation, and the spears are brandished." Quite poetic in many of these words and very descriptive, and it's thought that these descriptive terms of war attire and weapons indicates that the Chaldeans had red shields, and that would add drama, of course, to their attack. And then the warriors would dress with colors of scarlet to instill fear within their enemies. There would be chariots and torches moving along as they went to battle, and of course spears to be not just to be displayed, but also to be used. Verses 4 and 5, "The chariots rage in the streets. They jostle one another in the broad roads. They seem like torches. They run like lightning. He remembers his nobles. They stumble in their walk. They make haste to her walls, and the defense is prepared." More descriptive words of a battle scene with many chariots moving down roads and in the streets, and mighty warriors of Assyria being tripped up in their defense. Instead of being able to shield themselves, it would be the attackers who would have the upper hand. Verse 6, "The gates of the rivers are opened, and the palace is dissolved." Now, this foretells an important element to the coming attack. You see, Nineveh was built very close to the Tigris River, and so enemies could not cross the river and get into the city. And then there were walls built around the other portions that faced land. Now, according to a tradition laid out in Didorus, the Tigris River flooded, allowing for a breach in the walls that protected the city. And so the Allied armies took advantage of this breach, which I feel was a breach made by God. And they poured in, and they fought their way to the palace. Temples were sacked, and finally the palace was burned down. And verse 7, "It is decreed, she shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up, and her maidservants shall lead her as with the voice of doves beating their breasts." The first part of this verse in the King James translation says, "Huzab shall be," which is an expression meaning it is appointed, established, or to set up. And so the New King James rightly translates this as, it is decreed. God is the one who's decreed it. But a question comes, who is she being led away captive with maidservants? Well, it might be referencing the city of Nineveh as a whole. You know, cities are often referred to in the female sense. But it might also be referring to the Queen of Assyria. On the other hand, understanding their wickedness, this might also be speaking of a homosexual king. In any case, it states that maidservants will be led away captive with the voice of doves. And this is interesting. If you've ever heard a dove cooing, and you think about it, it actually sounds much like the whining and the groaning sounds of a person who is deeply saddened and crying as they move along. Listen to this sample that I put together. We can see why God would relate this walk of captives to the sound of doves, imagining hundreds or even thousands of these sounds going on. That's what it would sound like. In fact, there is a particular breed called the mourning dove, not mourning as in sunlight coming up, but mourning, mourning dove, and it's because of the sound that it makes. But the heart-rending racket of the captives would be much stronger as depression set in and as they beat their breasts as they went along. Verses 8 and 9, though Nineveh of old was like a pool of water, now they flee away. Halt, halt, they cry, but no one turns back. Take spoil of silver, take spoil of gold. There is no end of treasure or wealth of every desirable prize. Nineveh was one of the oldest surviving ancient cities of that time, and it's believed that Nineveh dates back to the days of Nimrod. Eventually, this place became a sprawling metropolis, as pointed out by Jonah. He said that it would take 3 days to walk from one end to the other. This indicates a span of approximately 60 miles. Nineveh was filled with people, and this is symbolized in verse 8 here, where it says it's like a pool filled with water. And the city itself, it was rich from conquering and pillaging other people. Why, Assyria fed on the achievements of other people. And the people of Nineveh, they were so used to the riches there that they would be dumbfounded when destruction finally came. But there would be no turning back to her glory days. The masses of silver, gold, and treasure would be ripe for the taking. And it would be taken away, and the city would be laid waste, and the people who lived there would either be killed or taken captive. And as was foretold here in verse 10, she is empty, desolate, and waste. The heart melts and the knees shake. Much pain is in every side of her, and all their faces are drained of color. People who become very fearful or famished or in pain or injured, they often lose color in their skin. In the medical field, it is called pallor, meaning an unhealthy paleness, a grayness, or a lack of color due to some kind of illness. In fact, fear itself can cause this to occur, and we are all aware of the expression, white as a ghost. Not that ghosts exist, but ghosts are portrayed often as being white or cream-colored. Now, in this physical process, what happens is that blood that circulates throughout the body in vessels and capillaries and such, it's drawn away from the skin and other places, and it draws into the body to protect vital organs. And this results in a paleness. And so for those people who are starving, the body, you know, it's trying to keep itself alive. It's trying to protect that which is vital for its function and survival. And even for those people who are fearful, their mind believes that something devastating is about to happen. And so the body moves blood from the extremities to these vital organs in anticipation of something harmful happening. And so therefore, that is why I believe God was inspired it to be written that their faces would be drained of color. Continuing in verse 11, question is asked, where is the dwelling of the lions and the feeding place of the young lions? Where the lion walked, the lioness and the lion's cub, and no one made them afraid. The lion tore in pieces enough for his cubs and killed for his lionesses, filled his caves with prey and his dens with flesh. Behold, I am against you. Now these verses, they seem to be describing Assyria both before and after the destruction. Regarding the description before their destruction, there is a famous set of stone carvings in a British museum known as the Assyrian Lion Hunt Reliefs, and in them are displays of Assyrian's decadence and their brutality. They portray its king very ornately dressed with decorated warriors, and they are slaying a large number of lions. However, though they are portrayed as conquering these wild beasts, they clearly revered the lion for what it stood for. You know, the massive relief here, it portrays small lion's heads decorating the king's bow. And the king is also wearing a bracelet that has a lion's head on both ends. In fact, there are other artifacts found, massive statues in Nineveh that portray a winged lion's body with an Assyrian man's head. I think these help us to understand how the Assyrians likened themselves to the brutality of packs of lions, but even worse. And though they might have become infamous for slaughtering lions, they actually considered themselves to be like lions by marring their prey and brutally ripping and tearing at other people while taking whatever they lusted for, taking it back to the den of Nineveh. In fact, it is likely that such a spectacle shown in this relief was made as a show that the Assyrians considered themselves like lions, but above the lions in their methods of attack, so they could slay even the mighty lion in packs. Verse 11 comes after speaking of the coming desolation of Assyria and asks the question, where is the dwelling place of these lions and the lioness and the cubs that were once never afraid? And the question is asked because Nineveh would become so desolate after the Chaldeans moved in and conquered her that for hundreds of years the city of Nineveh was thought just to be something of a myth and legend. There were few ruins left, and they were covered in the sands of time, and nobody even knew where this, you know, supposed city was or even that it existed. And so these few ruins that were left were not discovered for some 2,000 years. Verse 12 goes on to describe these people that were brutal, and they likened them to lions who tore at their prey and took more than enough for their cubs and symbolic as people. And in fact, it says, filling their caves with prey and dens with flesh. And God found this behavior and their attitude simply repulsive, worthy of total destruction of that empire. However, some of the Assyrian people did survive. We know that some were taken away captive. And interestingly, the capital of Austria's coat of arms displays two lions holding up a red shield with a crown. Germany also has many historic national symbols of its people that portray a lion. This could be evidence of their connection to Assyria. But there is also a legend of the ancient German city of Trier. It was believed to be founded by Celts in the 4th century BC, and Celts would have dwelt in the area of Assyria at that time. But this legend, which was recorded in the 12th century in a document called the Deeds of Treveri, states that the city was founded by an eponymous, and this was an otherwise unknown, unrecorded prince of Assyria named Trebeta. Now, Trebeta was said to be the son of Ninus, who was a king of Assyria, and this son apparently left Assyria some time before its fall, and he began a new colony in Central Europe. And so this would place the city of Trier's founding independent of and centuries before ancient Rome. So, even though it is possible dispersed and captive Assyrians eventually migrated to Central Europe, It's also possible that Assyrians already lived in this area long before the fall of Nineveh. Verse 13, "Behold, I am against you, says the Eternal of Hosts. I will burn your chariots in smoke, and the sword shall devour your young lions. I will cut off your prey from the earth, and the voice of your messengers shall be heard no more." God did cut off Assyria from devouring any more prey. Assyria came to its end. When God is against you, I mean, how can you stand? It's not possible. Regarding the messengers mentioned here being cut off, 2 Kings in chapter 18 gives us an example of how messengers of Assyria were sent to other nations who spoke boldly and harshly against them. And in this chapter in 2 Kings, it shows how they even spoke against the God of Israel. Obviously, Nineveh's repentance had long vanished. These messengers who intimidated people into submission and struck fear in the hearts of their prey were silenced. Chariots were burned, and young warriors who considered themselves fierce as lions were cut down by the sword of Babylon. The city that was built on the blood of nations who deceived and robbed and practiced idolatrous sorcery, this city would become a massive grave. And consider some of the graphic word pictures in the next verses, beginning in chapter 3. "Woe to the bloody city! It is all full of lies and robbery. Its victim never departs. The noise of a whip and the noise of rattling wheels, of galloping horses, of clattering chariots, horsemen charge with bright sword and glittering spear. There is a multitude of slain and a great number of bodies, countless corpses. They stumble over the corpses. Why is there so much devastation? Why is there so much death and destruction? Verse 4, "Because of the multitude of harlotries of the seductive harlot, the mistress of sorceries who sells nations through her harlotries and families through her sorceries." Without going into great detail of the carnage, God described the treachery of Nineveh and the onslaught of Babylon, whom he would use to carry out his wrath on that capital of violence and religious fornication. So devastating would the battle be that bodies were too many to be numbered. They would litter the streets and soldiers would stumble trying to make their way through the ruin. Verse 4 speaks of the multitude of harlotries that took place because of Assyria, and how Nineveh was a seductive harlot, a mistress of sorceries who sells nations and families through this a type of sexual witchcraft, it seems. And this sounds much like the words describing Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, as it says, and of abominations of the earth. Why, she is also portrayed as a great empire that made all nations and kings of the earth drink of the wine of her fornication, speaking of false doctrines and false religion. Like Nineveh, God says that he has judged the great harlot who corrupted the earth with her idolatrous sorcery. And this part of the prophecy here in Nahum again points to something that is coming. God will destroy the coming beast and its empire, which will likely be led by descendants of Assyria. And this final wicked empire, it will have its messengers from a seductive harlot being a false church and a false prophet who will feed the masses spurious words and threatening verbiage, while the beast itself will use stealth, guile, and violence, and intimidation and to feed its lust for power. We know God hates all sin. Every sin led to the death of his son, but the kind perpetrated by Assyria and Mystery Babylon the Great is particularly repulsive. And for this reason, God continued to say in verse 5, "Behold, I am against you, says the Eternal of Hosts. I will lift your skirts over your face. I will show the nations your nakedness and the kingdoms your shame. I will cast abominable filth upon you, make you vile and make you a spectacle. It shall come to pass that all who look upon you will flee from you and say, Nineveh is laid waste. Who will bemoan her? Where shall I seek comforters for her? Lifting up the skirts, as stated in verse 5, portrays exposing the shame of Assyria's abominations. All would see that she had done wickedly and suffered due justice for her harlotries. Its walls broken down and the destruction so thorough that it was like exposing a naked city. Though Nineveh was once beautiful in her wealth and decadent living, her beauty would become hideous to people. People would consider her demise and not feel compassion for her. Nobody would desire to help because she was no longer attractive. People would only want to flee from that place. There would be nobody to comfort her. In its heyday, Nineveh was proud and arrogant. Its people thought that the city was impenetrable, but God foretold how nothing could stand in the way of his righteous judgment. And he asks the question here in verse 8, are you better than Noamon that was situated by the river, that had the waters around her, whose rampart was the sea, whose wall was the sea? Ethiopia and Egypt were its strength, and it was boundless. See, God made a comparison of a great city of Noamon, and that thought that it was indestructible or unconquerable. Noamon was a city of Egypt by the sea, and it appears to have had waters formed around her. It was possibly built on a great delta. However, the waters were not the city's only defense. Both Egypt and Ethiopia vowed to defend this place. And yet it did not stand when God was behind the intended destruction. Interestingly, it's thought that Noamon was named after Haman or Ham, who was the son of Noah. And it's believed that Ham turned from God's way. And the Bible indicates that Ham did leave and dwell in the area that became Egypt. And therefore Ham would be a forefather of the Egyptians. And halfway through verse 9, it says, Put and Lubim were your helpers, yet she was carried away. She went into captivity. Her young children also were dashed to pieces. At the head of every street they cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound in chains. So verse 9 indicates that Put and Lubim were allies of Nineveh, but they were already conquered. They could not stand. Interestingly, Put was a son of Ham, and the region of Put's descendants was named after this grandson of Noah. Lubim was a region found in modern-day Libya. But even though these nations fought for this place, they were destroyed. And the statement saying they cast lots for her honorable men and all her great men were bound in chains, well, this tells how the educated and the craftsmen were taken captive. But the point is, such alliances that the wicked might put trust in would be of no help when God is against them. Verse 11, speaking again of Assyrian soldiers or warriors here, it says, You also will be drunk. You will be hidden. You also will seek refuge from the enemy. So the defenders of Nineveh would not be able to stand against the onslaught. It would be as though they were drunk, you know, trying to do battle after having a few too many drinks. Like those people Assyria intimidated and made fearful, now they would be the ones who became terribly afraid, and they would try to hide, and they would try to find refuge from the coming enemy. Verse 12, All your strongholds are fig trees with ripened figs. If they are shaken, they fall into the mouth of the eater. Strongholds refers to places where there would be a particularly large number of soldiers positioned as a defense. This would make that particular area strong and able to hold back the enemy, hence the expression stronghold. But God said these places would shake like a fig tree with ripened fruit. And if you've ever seen ripened figs, I mean, we don't get them too often in this part of the country, but when a fig becomes very ripe, they're quite fragile. And so hanging on a branch, if you shook the branch or the tree, they would easily fall when it was shaken. And this was likened to the soldiers in these strongholds that would fall easily in great number right into the mouths of their enemy. And it was because God was shaking the foundations of this place. Verse 13, Surely your people in your midst are women. Speaking of, you know, people fighting like women, and it's kind of a term, you know, it's God is not trying to offend women here, but they generally do not fight as boldly or strongly as men. They're just not built in for this type of battle. But God says here that your people, they're going to be like women, and the gates of your land are wide open for your enemies. Fire shall devour the bars of your gates. And these were gates that were made mostly of wood that would be all burned up when the enemy came and already made its way into the city because some were broken down, but then would burn the other gates and let more of the other soldiers pour in and conquer the city. Verse 14, draw your water for the siege. Fortify your strongholds. Go into the clay and tread the mortar. Make strong the brick kiln. There the fire will devour you. The sword will cut you off. It will eat you up like a locust. These are other expressions indicating that, you know, Nineveh would try with all its strength to defend itself, to even make more brick, fortify the walls, make it stronger. This would backfire. The fire and the sword would still penetrate its defenses. The place would be consumed. And the picture image, it's like a locust consuming a blade of grass. Continuing in verse 15, it says, make yourself many like the locust. Make yourself many like the swarming locust. You have multiplied your merchants more than the stars of heaven. The locust plunders and flies away. Your commanders are like swarming locusts, and your generals like great grasshoppers, which camp in the hedges on a cold day. When the sun arises, they flee away, and the place where they are is not known. And so even with increased numbers of soldiers and generals and captains and great warriors, if you will, these men would run for their lives in fear of the coming army. There would be nobody who could stop the destruction. Well, verse 16 indicates that Nineveh had many merchants who would have profited from her stolen luxuries and her idolatries. And this is reminiscent of Revelation 18, indicating that the great harlot has many merchants of the earth who were benefited through her fornication. These merchants will see her demise. They will be saddened from the fact that they can gain no more from her wickedness. Verse 18, it says, your shepherds slumber, O king of Assyria. Your nobles rest in the dust. Your people are scattered on the mountains, and no one gathers them. The imagery here portrays allies who vowed to tend to her needs as like a shepherd looking over a flock. And yet, they would not come. It would be as if they were sleeping on the job, asleep on watch. And the princes and nobles, they would become like dust scattered on the mountains, and no one would try to gather them together again, to form ranks and keep things together. In verse 19, your injury has no healing. Your wound is severe. All who hear news of you will clap their hands over you. For upon whom has not your wickedness passed continually? The wound God would bring was fatal. Assyria never recovered from the injury. The many people who suffered from Nineveh and Assyria's rule would be glad for her fall, symbolized by the clapping there. Her wickedness affected countless numbers, and many would be glad that justice was served. The book of Nahum tells us how this enormously wicked empire would fall. But there is a duality showing us that the evil empire led by the beast and false prophet will also fall. There is a warning that still rings out for the European descendants of Assyria found in Germany and Austria. You see, when the empire of the beast rears its head, messengers will be sent throughout the world, and they will intimidate people into accepting the mark of the beast. And though many do already have this mark today in some of its religious traditions, people will be forced to take the mark or suffer the consequences. However, those who are faithful to God will be protected. This prophecy fulfilled upon Nineveh, it speaks of terrible things that Assyria suffered, but it also presents a great hope to the world. You see, tyranny and wickedness will end. It will not prevail, even if it seems like the wicked benefit today. It will have its end, and what an end it will be. To me, the most important lesson that can be learned by God's people from these chapters is that we should always be on the side of God. Revere God and keep His commandments. This is the primary duty of all of humanity. If we are not on God's side, we shall fall, and what a fall it will be. But if we are on God's side, we can stand forever.